This has happened in individual spring areas, but this is not a region-wide closure for a fishery like this has not happened before.
Commercial salmon trolling will close in Southeast on Monday. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young wants a conversation about funding the war in Afghanistan.
So I suggest respectfully, we're asking for this debate. Let's find out where American people are. Let's understand one thing, 16 years is too long.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The spring season for commercial salmon trolling in Southeast Alaska is shutting down Monday, except for a few areas near hatchery salmon release sites. The spring season began in May and was to run through the end of June. However, poor returns of king salmon are prompting the closure. Grant Hagerman, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's troll management biologist for Southeast, says this is a first for a region-wide closure.
This has happened in individual spring areas. We did have an area near Ketchikan last year closed for several weeks for conservation concerns, but this is not a region-wide closure for a fishery like this has not happened before.
King numbers are low for wild stock fish returning to the Stikine River near Wrangell and Taku River near Juneau, as well as some other mainland rivers. Early catches of hatchery kings have not been strong either. Hagerman says region-wide, the hatchery king catch has been just 14% of the overall harvest. That's well below recent averages.
Hatchery fish are also down as well, in addition to those wild fish. And so with these fisheries designed to target those hatchery fish, you know, without really having many of those in the catch and concerns for those wild fish at this point, we felt like it was, no harvestable surplus on those wild fish, and that any fishery that directed Chinook fishery for troll or as incidental harvest in other salmon fisheries, basically being the chum fisheries, that we wanted to limit that, and basically closing these fisheries does that.
Fish and Game does test fishing on the Stikine and Taku rivers to determine actual numbers of kings making it back to spawn. The department says record low numbers of Chinook are showing up in the two rivers. Neither river is expected to reach an escapement goal or the number of fish that managers want to return to the river to spawn. Typically, kings from those two rivers make up 80% of the wild king salmon in Southeast Alaska. The troll fleet's quota, set under an international treaty with Canada, is not impacted by the closure. Pacific Salmon Treaty kings not caught in the winter and spring seasons will be carried over to the summer season in July. Congressman Don Young wants to know why Americans are still fighting in Afghanistan. He has co-sponsored a bill that would end funding for the war in a year, unless the president and Congress affirm the need for it. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Motives vary among the House members co-sponsoring the bill, but they all say it's high time Congress debates whether the war should continue. Republican Representative Walter Jones of North Carolina has Camp Lejeune in his district.
Speaker Ryan, he can initiate this today if he wanted to, and he doesn't seem to want to take the responsibility of the blood that comes from our soldiers and Marines dying in a country that will never change no matter what you do.
Congressman Young says now that the U.S. has eliminated Osama bin Laden, he'd like an explanation of U.S. goals for staying in the fight.
So I suggest respectfully, we're asking for this debate. Let's find out where American people are. Let's understand one thing. 16 years is too long.
Congress funds the wars, but it hasn't updated its authorization for the use of force in Afghanistan since 2001. Young says most Americans don't even think about Afghanistan anymore, and he wants people to be more engaged. This isn't like World War II, Young says, when just about every family had a soldier and the burdens were widespread.
We had metal collections, we had blackouts, we had watchouts, we had gas rationing, we had meat rationing, we had sugar rationing, because we all participated in the war that we declared.
It's not in the bill, but Young suggests a conflict tax as a way to keep attention on military actions that are not formally declared wars. 2,216 American service members have been killed in Afghanistan. Estimates of the cost exceed $1 trillion. Yeah, I was going to ask you about, of all things, the war in Afghanistan.
Oh, my gosh.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is hounded by reporters these days, asked to opine on health care budget cuts and presidential nominees. So the question seemed out of left field.
I have to admit, you're catching me by surprise, because it's like we haven't talked about Afghanistan in so long.
Murkowski is a member of the Appropriations Subcommittee that allocates money to the military each year, so she does hear about the Pentagon's needs and goals. But once she thought about it, she said a broader discussion in Congress may be a good idea.
We don't want to forget why we have sent men and women to go over there to fight for us. We need to know that the cause is right, and so to have that conversation in Congress is not unreasonable.
In a separate action, Senators Tim Kaine of Virginia and Jeff Flake of Arizona are calling for a new AUMF, authorization for the use of military force, against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. Kaine says their moves to get a vote in Congress have gone nowhere for years.
I frankly think this is partly hard because people don't want to cast a war vote, because there's going to be a consequence. It should be the gravest vote we ever cast. People want to duck from that if they can.
Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan is on the Armed Services Committee. He says he isn't opposed to a new authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan, but he doesn't want funding for deployed service members to ride on that decision.
My approach has been, I'll look at an AUMF, but I don't think right now that an AUMF for our troops in Afghanistan is something that if we say, hey, we're going to debate it and we can't get to a resolution, then we pull them out. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that at all.
Members of the 425 Brigade Combat Team based at JBEAR are expected to deploy to Afghanistan later this year. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage police say an officer shot and critically wounded a hatchet-wielding man early this morning during an investigation of car break-ins on the city's south side. The suspect, Howard Wayne Watson Jr., a 32-year-old Anchorage resident, was in critical condition at a city hospital this afternoon. Police say Watson's clothing fit the description witnesses gave when reporting several cars broken into near Chinaberry Circle. Acting Deputy Police Chief Kenneth McCoy says officers were searching the area when one of them spotted Watson running through backyards and hopping fences. McCoy says the officer approached Watson near Golden Morning Loop.
The officer issued him commands. He failed to comply, at which point the officer pulled his taser and tased him. What we understand is the suspect was able to pull free of that and then pull out a hatchet.
McCoy says the officer shot Watson multiple times and called for paramedics. Per APD policy, the officer's name will not be released for 36 hours as the investigation continues. Police have not yet announced any charges against Watson. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating how and why a Juneau-bound helicopter ferrying tourists crashed on Monday during a glacier excursion. The pilot and six tourists were treated and released at Juneau's hospital with minor injuries. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
The company released a statement that its helicopter was returning to Juneau at about 6 o'clock Monday evening when it ran into trouble on Herbert Glacier. The NTSB says the A-STAR helicopter sustained major damage and was disabled.
My understanding is a second helicopter was able to reach the site and were able to get the folks off of the glacier before nightfall.
That's the NTSB's regional aviation chief, Clint Johnson, in Anchorage. He said the Juneau-based charter company Coastal Helicopters is still trying to retrieve its aircraft. The company operates out of Juneau International Airport and regularly ferries tourists to and from the ice fields about 20 miles north of Juneau.
What we understand is this helicopter was operating in connection with a dog sledding excursion that's on the Herbert Glacier or in that area. But we're working very closely with coastal helicopters at this point right now to find out exactly what the circumstances were that led up to this accident and also what the extent of the injuries, if any.
No names have been released. Johnson says Coastal Helicopters is cooperating fully with the investigation. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School District lays off more than 200 teachers.
We've got 200 families out there that have been impacted. And how are they going to make ends meet in another month?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education, grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Many things divide the Senate and the House about the future of the state's budget. One thing that can unite them is the numbers they use to determine how big of a hole in the budget they have to fill. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman looked at what goes into those numbers and what it means for solving the state's budget problem.
It seems that the Senate and House disagree about so much that it's hard to see how they can ever come to an agreement on the budget. But Governor Bill Walker points out they all agree on at least one thing, a computer model. This model spits out numbers for how different proposals from lawmakers affect the budget in the long run. Here's Walker talking about the model's importance to negotiations in the Capitol.
We tried to end up with one model rather than dueling models around the building. I think that's all been combined into one financial model. Let's look at that. Let's look at the assumptions that are made. Let's look at the future of Alaska.
The nonpartisan Legislative Finance Division developed the model. Division analysts emphasize that the projections aren't precise, but at least they give lawmakers an objective source of information. This budget model allows legislators to plug in different assumptions to see how their ideas will affect the budget. For example, if you plug in a projection for higher oil prices that state officials say have a 40% chance of happening, then the state's budget is much healthier in the future. The models say that if the legislature makes no changes, one of the state's two main savings accounts, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, would be out of money next year. The other piggy bank, the Permanent Funds Earnings Reserve, would be empty in a decade. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says it's important for both sides to begin at the same place.
We're all using the same model. That's the most important thing, I think, for people to understand. So we're using the same model, only the assumptions are different.
Both the Senate and the House's plans look better now than they did a couple months ago. That's because the Department of Revenue's spring forecast predicted more royalties and taxes from oil. Assuming nearly 7% growth each year in permanent fund earnings, under the Senate proposal, the state's $2.5 billion deficit would shrink to $140 million by 2026. Michicki notes that is small enough that the state's savings would grow. That's because the size of the annual deficit would be less than the amount generated in earnings by the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Michicki says the division's assumptions that go into the model are conservative enough. The Senate plan would draw more money from permanent fund earnings each year to pay for state government. Permanent fund dividends would start at $1,000, and Michicki assumed roughly $200 million in spending cuts. Michicki wants the debate to focus on the merits of the two chambers' proposals.
It's just a philosophical difference on if it's okay to tax Alaskans for a greater level of savings or spending. The Senate does not believe that's an appropriate way forward during this recession, and the House apparently feels differently.
House majority members like Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton say there's an important difference to the assumptions the two sides make when they use the model. The House leaves more room for problems like lower-than-expected oil prices or investment returns.
Relying on something that's volatile and you have no control over is not the best way to plan for a stable state government that will help with stabilized economy and getting out of the recession we're in.
The House plan includes an income tax, and dividends would be a quarter higher than under the Senate plan at $1,250. The House plan also assumes more money will be spent on capital projects, and it doesn't include cuts to the budget. With the same permanent fund earnings growth, the House plan would lead to a surplus of more than $400 million. Seaton says the House plan also allows the state to restore the savings in the constitutional budget reserve that the government has spent over the past 4 years. But he emphasizes the importance of avoiding budget cuts.
If you don't want to see road maintenance done, if you want to see trooper posts closed, if you want to see teachers laid off from schools, those are the proposals of the Senate majority budget cuts.
So the two sides remain far apart, but the computer model makes clearer where the differences are. Lawmakers have 5 weeks to reach an agreement that would avoid a state government shutdown. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
220 teachers in the Anchorage School District yesterday received layoff notices. The pink slips were issued as legislators contend with a $2.5 billion budget deficit, leaving education funding levels for the coming year uncertain. Todd Hess is ASD's Chief Human Resources Officer. He says the mood around the district yesterday was somber.
We've got 200 families out there that have been impacted. And what are they going to do? And how are they going to make ends meet in another month? Those are all front and center in those families and those discussions. And their friends and colleagues are feeling that.
Around 100 of those layoff notices were issued to first-year teachers. Five tenured teachers were also notified of their impending layoff earlier this month. Hess says ASD did not release teachers who work in hard-to-fill categories like special education. ASD has to hire more than 250 teachers each year to make up for those who leave the district. Hess says the layoff notices will have a ripple effect on those on filling those positions in the future.
Trying to convince people that Anchorage should be their top choice is a tough enough job as it is, let alone adding another layer of uncertainty with whether or not they're going to have a job.
While the district has issued 220 layoff notices, the number of teachers without a job on next school year could be less depending on the cuts handed down by the legislature. If next year's funding levels are consistent with this year's, it's possible all of those positions could be restored. But Hess says that doesn't mean pink slip teachers are going to wait and see.
What would you do in your own personal interests and the interests of your family? Would you sit at home waiting for a letter that may or may not come? Or would you be out actively looking in other areas for different employment?
The Anchorage School Board already eliminated 90 teaching positions in the budget process for the coming year, which the district was able to make up for through attrition. Lawmakers in the Senate are proposing an approximately $65 million cut to education, while the House wants a slight increase. Dillingham police are investigating reports of more than 20 commercial fishing boats that were broken into over the winter. They say this is an annual problem, and of the recently reported break-ins, there did seem to be much stolen. KDLG's Nick Schlino reports.
More than a dozen skippers who store their boats at the PAF Marine Services Boatyard in Dillingham will find they are victims of some vandalism. Among them is Andrew Rosas, captain of the Deborah R.
I showed up a few weeks ago and I noticed that the tinfoil was ripped off my window, which was taped on from the inside, so it kind of led me to believe that it was broke into. I went up there, the window had been open for a few weeks, letting weather in and whatnot, and it just, the whole place was ransacked. Everything that could be gone through was gone through, and it was all thrown all over the floor and stomped on.
Rosas says nothing was stolen. Dillingham Chief of Police Dan Pasquarello says this is a common occurrence.
Pretty much every year around this time, as fishermen come back to Dillingham to prepare for the salmon season, we get reports that their vessels had been broken into over the course of the winter.
Pasquarello says some boats were found with sleeping bags and food items, indicating the suspects may have just been squatting there. Some things do get stolen from the fishermen each year, and Pasquarello says the public can help curtail that.
Help us solve the case and dry up the market. If somebody's trying to sell you expensive electronics for a fishing boat, you should be wary as to where they have obtained those items.
Pasquarello says police took a report of about 20 boats that were broken into and burglarized in January. In April, they took a report of two more they believe were just slept in. So far, no arrests have been made.
That was KDLG's Nick Schlino reporting from Dillingham.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're a K-12 teacher, consider the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus for summer in the rainforest continuing education courses. Two sessions offered, Basic and Beyond Arts Institute, July 24th through 29th, and Indigenous Arts Institute, July 30th through August 4th. Stipends, scholarships, and on-campus housing are available. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu/summerrain. This message is sponsored by UAS.
Many customers of Alaska telecommunications company GCI will see the cost of their internet service go up next month. GCI says rates for what they call their No Worries plan will increase 7 to 12%. That's roughly $5 to $10 per month. Company spokeswoman Heather Handyside says the increase is due to the cost of system upgrades in recent years.
We have increased the speeds for this plan three times in the past 2.5 years since we launched the plan with no increased cost to our customers.
The fee for GCI's most expensive service with the fastest speeds and highest data limits will not be affected. Handyside says the company always tries to provide the best service to its customers. That has meant building up the network to fit their needs.
The increases in the new technologies and investing in our network to make these better speeds and more data available, you know, require an investment, and sometimes those costs are passed on to our customers.
GCI announced its sale to a larger outside telecommunications company, Colorado-based Liberty Interactive Corporation, in April. The Northern Lights Dairy in Delta Junction will stay open, at least for now. The owners say they've reconsidered their decision from earlier this month to close. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the dairy's future hinges on finding people to work hard for low pay, a nationwide agricultural problem that experts say is even more challenging in Alaska.
It takes a lot of work to run a dairy, and at the Northern Lights Dairy in Delta Junction, the Lintelman family has, for decades, pretty much been doing it all.
We've done everything from milking the cow to packaging it to delivering it to the consumer.
Lois Lintelman and her husband Don own and operate the dairy, one of two in the state and the only one still operating in the interior. But the Lintelmans are getting on in years, and all but one of their sons have left to find work elsewhere. And the co-owners are having a hard time finding workers to take their place. So they decided a few weeks ago to shut down the dairy. Then last week they reconsidered and decided to keep it open, for now.
We're hoping things will maybe turn around. I mean, we have animals that will calve and come fresh in September, October, and we're hoping things might change.
Lintelman says they'll try again to find good workers to operate the dairy. She says that's been getting harder in recent years, mainly because they must compete against Delta's biggest employer, Fort Greely, and its missile defense base contractors.
Everybody thinks that they need to be getting wages like they do out at the military base, and a farmer can't pay $25, $30 to $40 an hour. We've advertised outside, and we even sent a fellow a plane ticket, and he never came.
It's more challenging here, I would say, because of the military base and the wages. It's difficult for the farmers to be competitive.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service agricultural agent Phil Kaspari says most Alaskan farmers struggle to find good employees. He said dairy workers are especially hard to come by because they must have or learn a wide skill set that includes farming, growing and harvesting feed, to animal husbandry, to operating a processing plant.
This time of the year, I will get phone calls from local farmers asking if I know of any good workers, you know, any young folks graduating that have an interest in agriculture.
It's a challenge for America in general, really.
Alaska Farm Bureau President Bryce Wrigley took a break from spring planting at his barley farm in Delta to explain the worker shortage problem that farmers nationwide face. Wrigley's day job is managing the Delta and Salcha Area Soil and Conservation District, and he spends much of the rest of his time out in the fields or helping operate a mill where he processes the barley. So he knows what it takes to run an agricultural operation.
You're milking cows, or you're grinding grain, you're making flour, you're raising beef, checking the hogs. This stuff happens around the clock.
Wrigley says it takes a special breed of person to commit their life to producing food.
They see that as a mission or as a thing that they want to do, and they're willing to forego the high dollar salaries and stuff like that.
Wrigley says there aren't that many people out there these days who choose such demanding work, work that he says is essential to Alaska's food security. He says the state must grow its agricultural workforce by helping young people understand the importance of producing food through education and activities like 4-H and FFA, or Future Farmers of America, so they'll be ready to take over when this generation of farmers is ready to retire. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Denali Park area is seeing a return to winter. National Weather Service meteorologist Ryan Metzger says a front associated with an area of low pressure over northwest Alaska is pushing across the interior and dropping snow at higher elevations.
We're expecting probably another 5 to 7 inches of snow on top of 3 to 4 inches that they've already received down in Denali Park.
Metzger says most of the accumulation has been west of Polychrome Pass, above 2,000 feet. But that snow is possible across a much broader area of the interior tonight.
The air is cooling aloft, so we have the potential for lower elevation snow throughout much of the interior. Even in the Fairbanks area, there could be some scattered snow showers, especially above, 1,000 feet.
Metzger says most of the snow in the Fairbanks area should melt when it hits the ground, but higher elevations could see a little accumulation. A warming trend is expected over the Memorial Day weekend, with temperatures in the region climbing into the 70s next week. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacob Resnick and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Casey Grove and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Nick Schlino in Dillingham, and Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue-ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.